Villopozos, Ms. Landau.
May it please the court. The issue before the court today is whether Mr. Cordova-Pozos was convicted in 1986 of a burglary offense that meets the generic contemporary definition of burglary of a dwelling. There are two reasons why he was not. The first is that the Illinois burglary statute prior to 1987 was interpreted in an overly broad fashion by including as residences outbuildings and abandoned buildings. Second, under the Illinois Accountability Statute, the law holds actors responsible for the actions of others. Beginning first with the overbroad interpretation of the burglary statute, this court
has
held.
What do you do about the Bales case? I mean, it seems to me the Bales case undercuts your argument, but maybe you see it differently than I do.
I do, Your Honor. The Bales case was decided before Mr. Cordova-Pozos was convicted. But the Bales case was a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the statute. It did not announce a new rule of law, but merely applied common sense to the existing definition. It did not rule out the possibility that the statute could be applied in an unconstitutional manner. It expressly declined to decide whether there were marginal cases that would be unconstitutional. So the Bales case didn't change anything. And in fact, the burglary statute, as Bales indicates, was the generic contemporary definition of burglary when it began. There was nothing new. It was just interpreted by some prosecutors in an overly broad way. And that was a problem that apparently continued after Bales, because it wasn't until June of 1986 that Senator Sangmeister made his speech on the Illinois Senate floor about the need to amend the statute. And from the language in his statement, it appears that the problem was an ongoing one, as the Senate had been informed by the Illinois Supreme Court that such prosecutions were actually occurring. So I don't believe that Bales undercuts my argument. In fact, arguably, it supports the idea that this was a real issue, and Bales just didn't decide it. The court has held that the generic contemporary meaning of a dwelling is any structure, including a tent or a vessel, that is used for human habitation. And this court has never held that abandoned buildings or outbuildings fit the generic contemporary definition of a dwelling. In fact, this court has indicated in Jackson that even houses lose their residential character if they're abandoned. And the documents in this case do not indicate what kind of structure Mr. Cordova-Pozos burglarized. All we know is that he pleaded guilty to violating the burglary statute, and it doesn't reveal to what else he admitted. And if we wanted to know that, we would have to have the plea colloquy, and we do not in this case.
Whose fault do you think it is that you don't have the documents?
Well, it is the government's burden, but I don't know that it's the government's fault in that this is a case from 1986 and they just may not be available. That's, I guess.
What do we do if they're not available?
Well, I mean, a lesser increase in his sentence would be available, a 4 or 8 level enhancement. The government's burden is to demonstrate the applicability of this crime of violence enhancement, and without it, I don't think they can.
But aren't you contending that there is some other way that he could have gotten convicted which would not fit the definition?
Yes, Your Honor, that is what I'm arguing.
Well, you have no burden to show that in any way?
No, Your Honor. Under Duenas-Alvarez, my burden is to demonstrate a realistic probability that the statute could be applied in an overly broad fashion. And with both of
have you cited any other cases here that show that the Illinois statute would permit the conviction of a person doing something outside of the bounds of a residence?
Well, Your Honor, I cited to the Silva case, the Bengay case, and the Pearson case, all of which indicate that such prosecutions were taking place. Garages, outbuildings, abandoned buildings. The
Does it make any difference whether the garage is attached or separate?
Well, that's a very complicated question of Illinois law. There was a big debate going back and forth. I think it's actually unsettled at this point. It does make a difference in that the unattached garage is not part of the, is not a living quarters, is not a residence, and would not be considered a dwelling under Illinois law. But there's some debate. I think there's a split between the appellate courts in Illinois about whether an attached garage is considered living quarters. It might be a very factual question.
How much weight do we give the indictment in this case? Didn't the indictment say that it was a dwelling place of a specific person?
Well, it tracks exactly the language of the statute. It doesn't give any information about what kind of dwelling place that would be. The problem was that dwelling place at the time was interpreted overly broadly. So while dwelling place certainly sounds like it would be a residence, the cases that I cited indicated, and the senator's statements indicated, that it was interpreted in such a way that it wasn't necessarily a residence. It could have been an outbuilding or an abandoned building.
An outhouse, too?
Oh, well,
outbuilding?
I suppose
you say, is that a place where you go and sit? You call that your dwelling?
Well, I hope not, Your Honor. But the outbuildings, I mean, it could, of course, include that, but I'm thinking more along the lines of tool sheds, I don't know, some other enclosed structure that is not a primary part of the residence.
When did he commit this crime? I mean, not the one that we're sitting in, but the one, the Illinois?
January of 1986.
86.
So to give a sense of the timeline, Bales was decided in September 1985. The burglary was committed in early 1986, and Senator Sangmeister's comments are later that year in June of 1986. Based on all the above, Mr. Cordova-Posos has raised a reasonable probability that he was convicted of an offense that is something other than burglary of a structure that is used for human habitation. If the court doesn't have further questions about that issue, I can turn to the other accountability statute.
Counsel, did you represent the defendant at the time of his conviction for the immigration offense?
Yes, our office did represent him.
Were you in court when the question about his prior conviction in Illinois came up?
No, Your Honor. I did speak to the trial attorney after.
I'm puzzled by why the necessary records from Illinois are not present here. It gives me the impression that nobody has seen the necessary records. Is that the case?
Well, there are not the records required to support an enhancement. Certainly, I would agree with that.
And what is in, apparently there is some sealed portion of this record. Have you seen what is in the sealed record?
Are you referring to the documents that are associated with the Illinois conviction?
Yes.
Yes, I have reviewed those.
And what's in there?
We have the order of sentence and commitment to the Illinois Department of Corrections and the indictment. And as Judge Prado mentioned,
under Illinois law, what function does the order of sentence serve? Is that the final judgment of conviction? Is that?
I believe that is the functional judgment.
And what does it say about what he was convicted of?
It lists the residential burglary statute, Chapter 38, Section 19-3, and it orders Mr. Cordova-Posos to serve a term. Let's see here. It's kind of hard to read. 4 years concurrent with another case. And he was given credit for time served. And that is the extent of the information in the order of sentence and commitment. And as I noted earlier, the indictment really just tracks the statutory language and doesn't give us any detail that would permit an inference that he burglarized a qualified dwelling. So we would need more in order to support the enhancement in this case. The accountability statute, which need not be charged in the indictment under Illinois law, renders the burglary statute overly broad because it creates liability for the actions of others. A person need not commit burglary, attempt burglary, conspire to commit burglary, or even aid and abet burglary. It is enough that they solicit burglary or that they are approvingly present and do not and continue to associate with the principal after the commission of the offense. It's a very strange statute. It has sort of pieces of aiding and abetting, solicitation, and accessory after the fact. And because under Illinois law, the prosecution need not demonstrate the capacity in which the defendant acted, the government can just pick pieces of each to meet its burden of proof. And I think the Taylor case, which I submitted via Rule 28J letter, is a good example of that. It doesn't require active participation, so it is distinct from aiding and abetting, which means that the district court's reason for enhancing Mr. Cordova-Poso's sentence was incorrect. And the court hasn't...
I thought there was some reference in the sentencing guidelines about these sort of participatory acts that can lead to punishment. That doesn't the somewhere make some reference to attempts or
yes, Your Honor.
Or solicitations or aiding and abetting as being equally of the same character as the principal offense itself?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's application note 4 to the guideline 2L1.2. And that does not include solicitation, however. It includes aiding and abetting, attempt, and conspiracy. Solicitation...
Would counseling fit that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Counseling.
Does counseling fit within
well,
that
counseling
list?
Counseling is that... Isn't that word in there?
I don't think it's in the application note.
Do you think the word solicitation has to be in there? It says includes, and it has several terms. Are those just examples of it, or is that non-exhaustive list?
Well, under the interpretation rules of the guidelines, the word including does not refer to an exhaustive list, but both the nature of the solicitation offense as well as this court's case law in another arena would counsel against adding it. To begin with the offense itself, solicitation is like a attempt to conspire. There's no agreement. There doesn't even have to be a completed offense. The solicitation itself is the offense. And that is different categorically than the offenses that are listed in that comment. So that doesn't really weigh in favor of adding solicitation as an offense. Moreover, in a different context, this court has held that solicitation is not a drug trafficking offense. So it would be contradictory to consider solicitation as part of the crime of violence, but not for a drug trafficking offense. This court's jurisprudence related to offer to sell in Garza Lopez and in Gonzalez would be undermined by that kind of logic.
Now, the Ninth and the Tenth Circuit didn't buy your argument. Is that correct?
That is correct. But the Sixth Circuit and there is a circuit split on the issue. But I would argue that the court's prior decisions in terms of offer to sell, which are solicitation offenses, would close that door.
Counsel, am I correct that the circumstance that you're addressing would infect all convictions under Illinois law, not just burglary of a dwelling?
Well, it certainly could apply to other convictions.
And what does that produce in the way of a requirement for producing documentation to establish it? How do you prove that the solicitation attempt was not in a case where it could have been in there without anybody saying anything about it?
Well, Your Honor, the answer is to get all the documentation for a case. If we would have had the plea colloquy in this case, all the questions would be resolved. And the court has resolved similar questions using a plea colloquy. It really doesn't change anything. If the documents are present and it makes clear, even the indictment could, in another case, make it clear what sort of offense was contemplated. This is also a very narrow window of time in terms of the burglary statute. It's only prior to 1987, so it isn't all cases going forward, but the accountability statute would apply more broadly. But the government does have the burden of proving the enhancement, and if the documents are complete, it'll have the opportunity to do that, but they are not complete here. I see my yellow light is on, if the court has no further questions, I'll finish.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Rigney?
Ms. Rigney, I think her cheering section is bigger than your cheering section.
Okay. May it please the court?
Yeah, pull that microphone down just a little bit so we capture you for posterity here.
Thank you. In response to counsel's argument that, that the Illinois burglary or residential burglary statute is overbroad, she does mention that the reason that this is overbroad was brought to light via the senator's comments during the legislative amendments that were occurring in 1986. And I would like to note to the court that the three cases that she does point to out of Illinois, which she claims show that these overbroad application of the residential burglary statute was actually occurring in Illinois, is People versus Silva back in 1993. However, the government would like to note that in this case, actually, they didn't necessarily state or reference other particular cases where they had actually applied the residential burglary statute in an overbroad manner. Instead, they merely noted that in 1987, Senator Sangmeister had commented that the Illinois Supreme Court had brought to their attention that some individuals were being prosecuted for breaking into abandoned buildings. However, in looking at People versus Silva, People versus Bengay, and People versus Pearson, it is the government's position that the senator's statement, if you look at the entirety of it, where he actually concludes by saying that in his interpretation, the new definition of a dwelling house would include the vacation homes that happen to be left not abandoned, but left unoccupied for periods of times. And so looking at the cases that the defense has cited and other cases that were being prosecuted at the time, the government's position is that this change to the definition was as a result of defendants who were claiming that they should not have been held liable or convicted of residential burglary, but instead of burglary, which was a lesser included offense and didn't require as much time in jail as the residential burglary. They were trying to find a way around that by claiming that they had broken into an apartment which was vacant or between tenants, a home which was a rental property that happened to be vacant, and another garden apartment which was like in a basement. And so they were trying to find a way to not be convicted under residential burglary. So if you also look at the senator's comments, that this now includes the vacation home which is being occupied or within a reasonable period intended to be occupied, covers these. So it's the government's position that this was actually not an amendment because it was overbroad and being applied in the manner that the opposing counsel is arguing, but instead it was just set to clarify that even if the home happens to be unoccupied at the time they break in, they will still be considered to be breaking into a dwelling. Of course, the government's position is that under the common sense approach, when you look at the generic contemporary meaning of the term dwelling, it does fall within the definition as set forth under the guidelines.
Is there any record out there in Illinois that there were any prosecutions made under this statute that gave it the broader definition of dwelling?
No, Your Honor. There were not any. I could not find. I know that Judge Avladis, the district court judge, and defense counsel has also attempted to locate these cases that the comments from the senator implies existed, but there were not any that were applied in this manner. In fact, Illinois had the burglary statute, which the people who were breaking into these abandoned or older buildings or buildings that were not used as dwellings, they were convicted under burglary and not residential burglary.
So nobody's been prosecuted for breaking into an outhouse?
Not to the government's knowledge, Your Honor.
Under this statute.
In addition, I understand that the opposing counsel mentioned the Jackson case. In that case, I believe the Fifth Circuit did hold that they had broken into an abandoned home, which was not a dwelling. But in this case, the home had been abandoned for 7 years, and that was not a reasonable period of time.
Do you agree with her interpretation of the Supreme Court, the Bales case?
Actually, the government does not agree. We do believe that the amendment that was made in 1987 was essentially just a codification of the interpretation that had been given to the definition of dwelling by Bales, and not only by Bales, but back in 1983, the Illinois Court of Appeals had actually already given it a similar interpretation in the court in the case of People versus Sexton, where the court actually gave it the same definition. And in fact, I would like to note that in People versus Pearson, the Illinois Appellate Court noted that the senator's comments, that he did comment on the abandoned buildings, but he also commented that the legislative history indicates the new definition was intended to encompass vacation homes and the like where the owners or occupants intend to reside in a reasonable period. So the change wasn't just because it was broad. It was, like I mentioned earlier, also intended to encompass these homes that happened to be unoccupied at the time the offense occurred.
Counsel, am I correct in understanding that the principal agent that develops the information about prior convictions is the probation department in preparing the pre-sentence report?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the prosecution attempt to advise them in any way as to what are the necessary documents that they must develop in order to establish the fact and nature of a prior conviction?
My understanding, in my limited experience with the court, has been that the prosecution at least notifies them that we do need the judgment of conviction. We don't, to my understanding, we don't normally request anything aside unless they're going to contest.
And do the documents in this case constitute a judgment of conviction?
We actually do have the certification of conviction from the Illinois court. As mentioned, it was submitted along with a pre-sentencing report provided to the court at the time of sentencing. And in fact, under Taylor, I believe that when there is an allegation that the convicting statute is broad, we can look to the charging instruments. In this case, what we do have is the indictment, which just a plain reading indicates that he was convicted, in fact, of burglary of a dwelling as contemplated by the guidelines.
Well, but an indictment doesn't indicate he was convicted of anything.
We do have
an indictment is a charge, and somewhere along the line, somebody said he was convicted of something, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, why don't we have the documents that show us precisely what he was convicted of?
The document that we do have indicates that he was convicted of the offense as charged in the indictment, and it was a one-count indictment charging him with burglary of a residential burglary.
I may be confusing this case with another case, but is there any doubt in this case as to whether he was convicted by a jury or whether he pled guilty?
Your Honor, the document actually does not indicate that a jury was ever impaneled. Just looking at the document, it appears it does have the date of conviction in 1986. Next to it, it says PG, which we can only speculate perhaps means pled guilty. Then it has JW and then the actual indictment to the indictment. We can only, like I said, speculate that he pled guilty, that he did not go to the actually have a jury trial. That information would probably be best provided if we had the other documentation.
Where do you satisfy yourself that there was no plea agreement?
The plea agreement with respect to the underlying, to the Illinois conviction?
Yes.
We just don't have any evidence of a plea agreement.
You want to take on the next problem?
Yes, Your Honor.
So to speak.
Now, with respect to the second issue, which is the accountability, the government does note that I believe there is presently a similar issue pending before the court in Sandoval versus Ruiz.
Was that the case that was heard in August?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
Now, with respect to the second issue, the government's position is that the accountability, the Illinois accountability statute, when you look at it, is actually essentially the Illinois aiding and abetting statute. The accountability statute, when looking at the case law actually cited and other cases applying the Illinois accountability statute, it is clear that it is different from solicitation because the accountability actually requires that the underlying offense have been committed. In this case, the underlying offense would have been the residential burglary. The case cited by opposing counsel, Taylor, actually explains that you do need more than mere participation, although you don't necessarily need to have active participation. In Taylor, it says active participation not required. However, it's clear that mere presence at the scene is not enough, but when you take other circumstances, and Taylor did note like five different factors that you can consider, whether the defendant was present, whether he maintained a close affiliation with the people who actually committed the crime, failure to report the crime, fleeing from the scene, voluntarily attaching himself to the group, all these are circumstances that give rise to this common design. You have to show that the person being charged under the accountability statute was part of the common design and not just merely present or having an approving presence. So there is more required in addition to the fact that the underlying offense be committed. And in Taylor, actually, although in their letter, opposing counsel just, it appears that the defense counsel, that the defendant in that case may have just been involved afterwards, but in fact there were statements that he had made to the police that showed he knew that they had a weapon. He was with them before and after the offense was committed, and so the court in that case did find that in light of those factors that you can take into consideration, he's part of the common design and therefore was appropriately held accountable for the offense of murder in that case based on those circumstances. So more than mere presence and more than merely soliciting somebody is actually required for the accountability statute. Illinois actually had their solicitation statute back then, which the opposing counsel is not claiming that Mr. Cordova was actually charged with solicitation, but instead accountability under their accountability statute. And the government's position is that that is sufficient under the federal sentencing guidelines to hold him accountable because it includes aiding and abetting. And although the definition includes, in Illinois, includes the word solicit, as Judge Alvarez noted, in the district court judge, is that in this sense, it's not used to mean anything different than perhaps procure or, you know, counsel or to, you know, seek the assistance of somebody else, but something more than merely soliciting is required under the accountability statute. I have, the government has nothing further, and we would ask that you affirm the conviction for Mr. Cordova, unless you have any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Landau.
Is there anything in any of the documents that you've seen about this Illinois conviction that uses the word attempt or aiding and abetting or soliciting?
There were two charges at the time, one of which was attempted residential burglary, but no, the words aiding and abetting or conspiracy or anything like that did not appear in the documents, but we wouldn't expect them to because under People versus Tansiel, the accountability statute need not be charged in the indictment. And I need.
So we are searching for something that need not be in the records, and yet we're saying somebody's got to show whether or not it was there. That I just don't understand the task that you're saying the government has to undertake.
Well, this is the task. Show what he pled to. Show what dwelling.
Well, did he plead? Do we know that?
Well, we don't, actually. The PSR does reflect a guilty plea, but the documents that are attached to the case do not reflect one way or the other. But assuming that the PSR is correct, and I don't have any reason to believe that it's not in that regard, even if he pled guilty, we would have some indication there was a factual basis in the case to support the conviction. That would reflect the type of structure that he burglarized. It's not asking the government to do any more than they've done in any other case.
Well, is it your understanding or expectation that there was a guilty plea and it's been lost. A plea agreement has been lost. Nobody can find it. Is that the situation?
I don't know what the situation is, Your Honor. I did not personally seek out the plea colloquy. It could be that it is lost. It could be that it was never transcribed. I don't know, and I don't want to misrepresent. Looking at what documents we do have, the government is incorrect that the indictment reflects sufficient specificity. Even if we assume that he pled guilty to the indictment and we don't actually know that, the indictment doesn't give us what we need to support the enhancement. It just says that Mr. Cordova Pozos knowingly and without authority entered the dwelling place of Daniel Andrade with the intent to commit therein a theft in violation of the Illinois burglary statute. And dwelling place, that's what we're talking about here. It's a term of art. And at the time that this conviction occurred, it was a term of art that was applied improperly to garages and outbuildings and abandoned buildings, as evidenced by the senator's comments in 1986. And I think that this is unusual in that it must have been a continuing problem. There was the Sexton case in 1983, which is a court of appeals decision indicating the proper scope of the statute. And then there's a further question by the Supreme Court in 1985. And then it isn't until 1986 that the senator got on the floor and made these comments about how people were actually getting prosecuted for burglarizing abandoned buildings and outbuildings. Not every court clarification of a statute prompts an amendment to that statute. This must have been a real problem. And if we look at what the senator actually said, it's pretty clear. We are having people prosecuted for residential burglary for breaking into unoccupied buildings such as garages. We redefine dwelling to mean a house, et cetera, et cetera. It covers a vacation home that you intend to reside in, and that if you burglarize that, you would still be committing residential burglary. But it tightens up some of these cases where we got old abandoned buildings around our garages and stuff would not be residential burglary. So I don't know how much clearer he can be that it is a problem as of 1986. It wasn't solved in 1983, and it apparently wasn't even solved in 1985 by the Supreme Court. Also, it's not the defendant's burden to show that Mr. Cordova Pozos himself was convicted under the accountability statute, under an overbroad interpretation of the burglary statute or the accountability statute for that matter. It isn't even the defendant's burden to show that somebody in the caption was later convicted somewhere in the case for an overbroad interpretation. I only need to show a reasonable probability that such prosecution in fact occurred. And this senator's statement is sufficient to do that. Turning to the accountability theory, we would not expect that to appear in the indictment. Doesn't understand seal it, need not be charged in the indictment. And I looked at cases and codes, and there's no indication that it would appear in the judgment either. So the only solution is to get that plea colloquy. The government has failed to show that accountability falls within the generic contemporary definition of burglary of a dwelling. Being knowingly present plus an accessory after a fact, I don't know exactly what that is, but it's not burglary. The actions in Taylor are no more than that. It is unclear to me how Taylor participated at all in that offense. He was a passenger in a car, and another passenger in a car got out to commit an offense and got back in the car. He wasn't the driver. He didn't assist or counsel or command or procure or anything. He knew what was going to happen, and he didn't do anything. He didn't call the police. And then after the offense was committed, he fled from the police. And I don't know exactly what that offense is called, but it wouldn't be murder. And if you change the word murder to burglary, it certainly wouldn't be burglary. So it doesn't fall within the generic contemporary definition of burglary of a dwelling. The court has no further questions. I'll conclude.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at